Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
First of all, with these gravitational waves that were detected by LIGO and Virgo, I think it would probably be good to start by telling people what Virgo and LIGO actually are and what they measure. Because I sort of was baffled even by the title of the article. I'm like...
Well, that's a very good question. So LIGO, I don't know what it's called, but I don't know how it's pronounced, but it stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And Virgo has probably got some similar acronym, which I haven't found yet. But LIGO is situated in the States, and in fact, sort of on both sides of the States, in Washington State and Louisiana. And Virgo is in Italy. And together they make up what is, as it says in the name, a gravitational wave observatory. And what they are looking for is, as the name suggests, gravitational waves. And so these come essentially from the collision or melding or bringing together of enormous objects in the universe. And when that happens, you get gigantic amounts of energy released, and some of that is manifested in these gravitational waves. And so these have made the news recently because last year, in fact, on May the 21st, these two observatories found the largest gravitational waves that have yet been detected. And that was kind of big news. Now, I don't know if you got the little pictures that I sent you of said gravitational waves.
Yeah.
And you'll agree with me that they are small.
Yeah, they don't look like much.
Yeah, it just basically looks like four squiggles, basically. So it's four little peaks. They lasted a total of 0.1 of a second. So this is a tiny, tiny, tiny effect on Earth. But from this, and they've only just published this in Nature this month, they have figured out that this gravitational well, these gravitational waves, these biggest ones ever seen, must have come from the collision of two black holes. And somehow they managed to figure out that these black holes, and don't ask me how they do this, but they managed to figure out these black holes were about 16 billion light years away. So essentially, they came from a time when the universe was about half the age that it is now. So that's an awfully long time ago. And as I said, they figure out that this has come from the collision of these two black holes. And what has happened is these two black holes have come together, they've collided, and they've made one big black hole. And this big black hole has a size around about 142 masses of our sun, which is pretty darn large when we're sort of comparing it to Earth size anyway, because the sun is massive compared to the Earth. They reckon that when these came together, they gave out energy that is equivalent to about 8 solar masses. So this is through Einstein's equation, E equals MC squared, which tells you about the equivalence of mass and energy, which is a massive, massive amount of energy, but it's been dispersed over the entire universe, essentially. And we're just getting those little squiggles as a result of that. And
so there is something significant about this size, right? It's a
yes, very, very, very much so. And this is a size that shouldn't be allowed, really, under the current theories. So these calculations sort of say that the black holes that led to this, or that were involved in this collision, were around about sort of 60 and 80 solar masses of our sun. And this kind of goes against the theory of black holes, because what we think about black holes is that they're formed by the collapse of stars. And it's when stars get incredibly massive and sort of collapse under their own weight into these incredibly, incredibly dense species. And so if this is correct, if their calculations are correct, then that's probably going to lead to maybe a rethink about what we know about black holes. And you know, so this is really, really big news for all the folk out there.
If I'm correct from my understanding, yeah, weren't they saying you can't possibly have a black hole that big, because if the corresponding star had been that big, then it wouldn't have formed a black hole, it would have just kind of exploded. Is that what
they say? Exactly. And so, you know, we think we know a lot about the universe, but we know very little, really, if we're going to be absolutely truthful. I mean, we've got all this stuff called dark matter out there. We don't know what it is. So there's still a heck of a lot to learn about the universe. This whole thing about black holes and everything, you know, these are just theories. They're pretty good theories at the moment, but, you know, it might be that now they're going to need some work on those theories. They need to look at them again, all because of these four little squiggles that lasted 0.1 of a second. Utterly amazing. And as I often say on this, more work is needed. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what comes of all of this. But this is a relatively new technique, this whole gravitational wave thing. So, you know, some very, very exciting stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Well, and then to move to the second topic is also out of this world, but not quite so distant, maybe, just over the ditch on the moon. And they found some rust on the moon. Now, I guess to begin with, what causes rust and why wouldn't you expect to find that on the moon?
Very good question. So in order to make rust, you're going to have oxygen. Okay, that's the number one thing. So what you find on, for instance, Mars. Mars is a lovely red color, and the red color is due to essentially rust, which is a compound of iron. It's a type of iron oxide. So this is what you get when you react metallic iron, as everybody knows, with oxygen. You leave that around for a while and it'll start rusting and you get that lovely red color. Now, anybody who's looked at the moon lately will know that there's not a lot of red on the moon, you know, beautiful white color, or, you know, black, et cetera, et cetera. And what the Apollo astronauts found when they went to the moon was that there was a lot of absolutely pristine iron on the moon, which is, you know, quite surprising in itself, I guess. But when you consider that the moon, A, doesn't have an atmosphere, and B, therefore has no oxygen, then it's really not surprising that you're going to get this pristine metal there that hasn't been, you know, touched. People in Hawaii, in fact, have been interested in is, you know, what's going on the moon. And so about 10 years ago, they were looking at water on the moon, and they found that at sort of higher latitudes, there was a significant amount of water. And of course, water contains oxygen. And so therefore, they sort of started having a look at the rocks and stuff like that and seeing what the effect of water or whatever would be. And to their surprise, what they've found now is the signature for a thing called hematite, which is an oxide of iron. And again, made from the reaction of iron with oxygen. And so then the big question comes, right, how does the oxygen get there? Where does the oxygen come from? You know, space is a vacuum. There's, you know, supposedly anyway, it's as close to a vacuum as you're going to get. There's not really a lot in space. So where does the oxygen come from? And, you know, this is something I've never thought about, and it's kind of interesting. The oxygen actually comes from the Earth. And so what happens is that when the Moon and the Earth and the Sun all align in that order, then we have a thing called the solar wind. Okay, the solar wind comes from the Sun, and it is, you know, essentially a wind, and it blows, quote unquote. And what actually is thought to have happened, or is happening, I guess, is that you are getting oxygen blown out of the atmosphere on Earth when everything's in the right orientation, and it blows onto the moon, which is really quite amazing. But obvious when you think about it. So this is their theory anyway, and what they are seeing is that the hematite, the iron oxide that they see, is only present on the side of the moon that faces the Earth. And again, if you know anything about the moon, the time it takes to go around the Earth is pretty much exactly equal to the time it takes to go around its own axis. And so therefore, always the same face of the moon is facing the Earth. So we only see one side of the moon. They see that the amount of hematite is higher on that side of the moon than it is on the other side. And again, that makes sense when you're talking about the solar wind blowing the oxygen onto the moon. So, you know, I found that kind of interesting. And again, I'm sure there'll be more work on this. And, you know, people are talking about going back to the moon one day. I presume it'll happen at some stage, but, you know, there's obviously a lot more investigation that needs to be done. You know, and it's, you know, hard to believe, I guess it's nearly 50 years since somebody once, well, you know, since the last person stood on the moon. You know, it's an awfully long time. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more science that needs to be done up there. So, yeah, kind of cool.
All right. Well, then to turn to our last one today. It's very bizarre, and I think this is another example of one where people need to watch the video and see it for themselves, because these scientists are floating these toy boats upside down beneath this levitating strip of water. Now, how do they do this? Sort of what forces are at play, I guess?
Well, again, the first question comes, you know, why the heck did they study this? You know, there's some weird stuff that gets studied out there, but this is all to do with sort of fluid flow and things like that, and physicists are interested in that. And so a bunch of scientists in Paris, and they've just published this in Nature, so it shows you that it's, you know, important work. And what they've done is, as you say, they've made little toy boats float upside down on the bottom surface of some levitating liquid. And so the way that they do this is that they're using vibrations. So what they have got is liquid in a closed container, and they found that if they use vibrations of the right intensity and the right frequency, that they can actually get a strip of this water essentially to levitate within this closed container. So what you then have is essentially a strip of water that's got a top side and a bottom side. And obviously we all know that things float on a liquid. You put something down on top of a liquid, it's going to float, provided that its density is less than that of the liquid. But what these guys did was to actually take a little toy boat and put it on the underside of this floating strip of water, and then make it float on the underside of that floating strip of water. And again, the way that they do this is all by using vibrations. Now, the reason that they can levitate the water is that the vibrations stop these little droplets forming on the bottom of the water. Once you get droplets forming, then the whole thing collapses and it'll just fall down to the bottom under the influence of gravity, obviously. So again, using the right frequency of these vibrations, they've got this strip of water levitating. And so what they then have is essentially a piece of, let's say, compressed air beneath this water. The air pressure beneath this water has got the water pressure on top pushing down on it, and it's also got gravity pushing down on it. But it's that increased air pressure is sort of pushing up against the water as well. And that's essentially, to my understanding, you know, is what makes this boat float underneath it, okay? So it's a very subtle combination of effects, and providing you get absolutely everything right, your liquid will levitate, you've got your little boat, that'll float on the bottom surface of the water, and away you go. Now, as you quite rightly say, you really should search this out on the net and have a look at the little video on this, because, you know, what I'm saying really doesn't do it justice, but it is kind of cool. It looks sort of like an anti-gravity sort of thing, which is, you know, really, really nice stuff. So obviously, there's got to be some sort of use for this, because otherwise, you know, why study it? So they're talking about that it might be useful when it comes to separating sort of little solids out of liquids, so plastic particles and stuff like that. Perhaps they might be able to use this sort of technique to remove plastics from the ocean, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but very,
en
very
mass. Just
obviously they're just doing it on a small scale at the moment, but you know, all the physical principles and everything are obviously very much of interest in this. So again, it'll be interesting to see where all of this goes. And that's, you know, that you can say that about all science, really. That's what happens. You make these, you know, cool discoveries, and then, you know, what happens to them, what comes about as a result of these discoveries, you know, that's the really interesting stuff. In addition to, I guess, the sheer interest of all of these things that we've talked about today. So, yeah.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.